May it please the court, I'm Jackson Manassian for appellants Los Molinos, Stanford Vina, and Peyton Pacific. California water rights have been real property rights pursuant to 150 years of law. The United States Supreme Court has held as much twice. In 2021 and again in 2022, plaintiffs who have adjudicated senior water rights had their water taken and confiscated pursuant to emergency regulations and curtailment orders adopted and implemented by the State Water Resources Control Board, which is the regulatory agency of the state of California responsible for administering the water rights system. For California, it's 39 million people and 211,000 miles of creeks and rivers. Plaintiffs brought takings claims and due process claims, arguing that they were entitled to a due process hearing on the determination of defendants who are officers of the State Water Resource Control Board that plaintiffs' use and diversion of water was unreasonable under Article 10, Section 2. The regulations declared the use and diversion to be unreasonable under the California Constitution, provided that the diversions would cease and the water would be taken at specific times for in-stream flows for migrating fish, and provided that the orders would be issued to notify water users when the regulatory requirements were in effect. Plaintiffs were three of 22 total water right holders on Mill and Deer Creek, which the regulations and orders targeted. The trial court erroneously held that plaintiffs were not entitled to a due process hearing on whether or not their use and diversion of water was unreasonable under Article 10, Section 2 in the regulations or in the orders.
Let's try to jump to the I think we're pretty familiar with your general arguments.
Okay.
It seems to me that the crux of at least your due process argument is this sort of distinction in the case law between adjudicatory versus legislative. But it's kind of it's almost like adjudicatory or legislative it's almost, there's a little bootstrapping or circularity of that, because something that fits within these certain criteria is adjudicatory, and then you have to have more process, and something that has less is legislative. And so when I look at all the cases, you know, I think we have Harris, and we have Hotel versus City of Oakland, I guess, and, of course, by Metallic. But you look at the Ninth Circuit case, Halverson and Sampson versus Bainbridge. We have one case I think we found it was adjudicatory, and that was, but it was, I think, like, it was very, very few. It was less than 22, I guess, and then in Harris. And in the other cases we didn't find, but they seem to be also a whole shoreline or all the hotels in the city or something like that. This case seems to be kind of, by my looking at it, kind of somewhere in the middle of that. So how do we, you know, when you're a judge, you look at precedent, it's nice if you have something right on point, but it's hard for me to see how we have something right on point. We seem to be kind of right in the middle. So how do we conclude whether this is few or not few?
We recognize that that's not the legal standard. That's the legal standard when we're examining if a general statute, general regulation, like we had in those cases you're listing, is adjudicatory in substance. But in this case, they aren't even general on their face. They are adjudicatory, declaring the use and diversion unreasonable and ordering it to cease. That is, Harris is a general plan amendment of an entire county. Halverson is a flood control plan for an entire county. Hotel Motel Association is a general code amendment of the city of Oakland.
When you use the word general there, it's got the same circularity thing that I was struggling with, adjudicative and legislative. Is, you know, at the end of the day, what is the difference between a general and a not general? It seems to me it turns on, it turns on the number, but does it depend on that number compared to, like, what's the denominator or the numerator, whichever one? Like what are we comparing it to?
Justice.
Does it make any difference in this case that there's like two or maybe three water rights holders that have the lion's share of the water in these two creeks, and they're the ones that are super affected? It seems like under Harris, that statute or that rule that we did find to be adjudicative concerned a relatively small number of persons, and then we went on to say, and especially the one entity was exceptionally affected that was in that case. And so here, that seems to maybe put some support to the fact that since three are exceptionally affected because of the fact that most of what may play into it. I'm just trying to figure out, you're just saying general, and I'm not sure that's as helpful to me, you know, general versus not general, because that seems a little bit like you're sort of assuming the answer.
Justice Holmes answered this question for us in bimetallic when he said general, in which all are equally concerned and stand alike. And so if we're looking here, we have to look at the actor, whether it's the County of Riverside and Harris, City of Oakland, or here, it's the State Water Resources Control Board overseeing water rights for 39 million people and a very large state. Well, we know this is not general because it's limited to these 22 water right holders on two small creeks. If it was, and let's be clear, that is a small number if we're going to adopt the trial court and the state's argument.
Do we look at that in comparative terms? Because you seem to be implying that when you're say 22 versus whatever those big numbers were you gave out for the whole state. Or would 22, is just 22 always enough, even if it was a tiny little agency that you know, it was only over those 22, right? What they always have to do. I'm just trying to figure out.
I'd suggest that the law is that this is not a numerical assessment when on its face it's adjudicating and confiscating rights. We look what would have been general, which would have been all water right holders, all places, salmon, steelhead, swim, something of that effect.
What if there are 22,000 people on these two creeks? Not 22.
That would not alter the right to a due process hearing. Now,
then your position would be that the water board would have to do 22,000 individualized hearings?
I did not say that, Your Honor. Under Matthew v. Eldridge, they have great discretion on how they form the due process hearing, post-deprivation, pre-deprivation, consolidated, but that's not at issue in this case. It's whether there was a right to a due process hearing to begin with. The trial court says no and the state says no. We argue yes. The fashion of the hearing, I don't think, is before this court.
Your answer to Judge Forrest is the answer you just gave, then what if it's more than 22,000? What if the water board, why under your the way you're framing it, if the water board issued a rule that apply or a ruling, however you want to, adjudicated something for the entirety of the state, why wouldn't that? It just seems the number has to matter, doesn't it?
Adjudications in water right proceedings, which does happen, those are evidentiary proceedings, but they can adopt general rules of reasonableness, general standards. They could say,
they're saying they did here for these two, but they just did it for these two creeks instead of the whole.
They did not. They declared that the diversions were to cease and were, in fact, unreasonable. It wasn't a general rule, it's unreasonable to dewater a stream for fish. They made findings of fact that the diversions had to cease, were unreasonable, and that if diversions were to occur, it would be subject to fines. That's not general in any way compared to those cases Your Honor has listed.
I had a different question. I don't want to get you guys off track. I had a question about a different subject matter for you. Is that okay if I jump in?
So what I'm struggling with in this case is mootness. And let me explain why. Mootness has the two-step exception. I agree that this is it can evade review because it can happen so quickly. I'm good there. I also agree that is California going to have more droughts? Unfortunately, yes. But what I'm having difficulty with is understanding why we think this method, we're really confident, like really confident that this method would occur again.
Because they've done it in 4 of 7 years. Declared an emergency 2014, 2015, 2021, 2022. And with emergency regulations or curtailment orders, no due process hearing, no compensation. The allegations are accepted as true, such through a motion to dismiss. Very clear that the standard of a likelihood or reasonable expectation of reoccurrence is met. And the complaint alleges this is the project for in-stream flows on the creeks. They're going to keep doing this. And under the Alaska case, we need not look at whether the orders and regulations are still in effect. We only need to look at whether there's a chance or a reasonable expectation or likelihood that it would be done again without a hearing or due process.
And I guess my question is that I understand they may declare an emergency again, but don't you have to show there's a reasonable likelihood that the provisions at issue here would be the response to the emergency?
What better allegations could we have than they're doing it in 4 of 7 years? The salmon and steelhead come back every year. The state themselves are arguing it's an annual migration, how important Mill and Deer Creek are for these species. We have past conduct consistent with them doing this. This is the tool. We know in society that emergency assertions are being overused and abused. So here, the standard of the likelihood of reoccurrence and the expectation, it's satisfied.
I guess we could ask, obviously we probably will ask your opposing counsel, but what else, you know, what else could they do if there was a drought and they thought the steelhead needed a certain amount of water? Is there some other mechanism they could
use? Yes, Your Honor, and the complaint alleges, and it's accurate, it should be undisputed, that there have been many efforts by government to create in-stream flow projects on these creeks for salmon and steelhead, drilling wells, paying water users.
Well, I guess, so, why wouldn't they do, why don't we think that it's a reasonable likelihood that they would do the other thing instead of doing this thing you want?
Because they're taking it for free, and they keep doing it, and the complaint alleges this is the substitute project.
Judicial notice of human nature. I guess if you can get it for free, you'd rather not pay for it. I guess.
How many years would we, if they'd done it all 7 years, would this be a better case? Every drought year we've had since 2014,
they've done whether this. They have any plans to do anything different.
I would like to save some time.
I want to ask you one question about the takings issue, and hopefully Judge Owens will be generous.
I will.
Thank you.
So what is the effect of the California decision saying that these curtailment orders are not a taking?
Well, I think one thing the trial court got right was that case, the trial court said it didn't really address due process, even though it had a ruling on due process. I think what we take from that is it's wrongly decided, but I don't think it has much relevance under Ex parte Young and the takings clause question presented in this case.
Why not? I mean, don't we give effect to state decisions on federal law matters?
I don't think there's any argument that that case is binding in this case. I'm not familiar with that from the state or the trial court. Those are different emergency regulations and curtailment orders from a different drought. There was no reasoning or explanation, really. The Court of Appeal just said due process and takings clause are not violated under this extraordinary circumstances. And
I might ask the question slightly differently, your takings claim feels a little convoluted. Like, you know, you're like, we're not asking you to stop the taking. We're just asking you to issue a declaratory judgment that they got to pay us if they take it. All of which makes me think, wow, it'd be way simpler just to go to state court and. Because you obviously have the ability to go to state court. But it seems to me like you don't want to go to state court because you're going to lose, or you did lose, and you probably will lose again. That doesn't seem to be a good reason to go for the federal court to do, you know, to do the gymnastics that it seems like you're asking us to do in order to hear your takings claim. Another way of putting it is, why shouldn't I see this as all just a way to try to get around the state court? You know, maybe they're wrong. Maybe they're wrong. State courts get things wrong sometimes, but they denied your takings claims. So you're like, we want to get this done in the federal courts instead.
It's a closely related but distinct issue. But after Williamson from the United States Supreme Court, the federal courts are open to takings claims. There's no more requirement that we go to state court.
That doesn't belong here, though, right? Like, wouldn't that belong in the Court of Federal Claims or something like that, or? or no, maybe not, but that's not, you're not saying you're bringing a takings claim here. You're saying you're bringing at least you're not asking for reimbursement.
It's a takings claim, but it's for prospective relief, which is the relief limited under Ex parte Young. And so trial court didn't think we were inconsistent with Ex parte Young. Trial court said, this is violative of the general rule that you can't enjoin a taking. And there is a general rule under Monsanto and Nick V. Scott repeated that you can't enjoin a taking. But we're not trying to enjoin a taking. And as Vargo v. Casey said, the trial court decision in this case is neither well-reasoned nor binding, because there simply is no requirement under the takings clause, ex parte, or any other authority that says you got to go bring that takings claim in state court first. That is not a barrier. So here we're seeking prospective, declaratory, and injunctive relief. They can take the water, they can do everything they're doing, but they got to hold the due process hearing and they got to pay compensation prospectively. They don't have to pay a dollar if we win. It's up to them. But this is not a case where we're trying to stop the taking. It's not retrospective relief. It goes to the method of the taking and conforming.
So you think that you can distinguish Nick on just that ground? I'm only asking for prospective equitable relief. And so then Nick's rule about if you have an avenue for relief at law, you don't get equitable relief.
I do think you can distinguish it, because what Nick is saying is that the Constitution provides for taking of property with compensation. Constitution allows that. And so parties can't stop an action that's a taking, because the government can do that if it pays compensation. Well, here, we're not asking that they pay money. We're just saying you conform to the Constitution going forward. Prospectively.
But you are asking that they pay money. You're just not asking. You're asking us to do everything except for, it's like you want us to pre-adjudicate. You want the federal courts to pre-adjudicate that it would be a taking, that they have to pay money, issue an order, and then everything except for the last part that, and then I guess the if once you had that, then if they took the water, then you'd go in and say, contempt?
Isn't
not
that
paying before? I mean, you see what I'm saying? It just feels like you're trying to circumvent and use an equitable relief to get essentially everything that you would get with a damages claim for takings.
That's what Ex parte Young is in general. You are asking for prospective relief based on conduct to the point of the conduct leading up to the point.
No, you're kind of like using Ex parte Young here would be kind of like saying these people can't do this, you know, not take it out of the takings context. These people can't do it, but we're okay with them doing it. We just want them to pay us money if they do it. And that would feel like a weird use of Ex parte Young, since the whole point of Ex parte Young, as we learned in law school, is you don't allow paying money, right? It's to get injunctions. But here you're trying to get an injunction that requires paying money.
If they want to do the conduct, and under Milliken v. Bradley, the Supreme Court's made clear.
It could be like, you can beat my client as long as you pay a certain amount of money. You know, we're fine with, you know, we want an injunction, they can't beat my client. But they can do it as long as they pay a certain amount of money. It feels like you might as well bring a claim. I wish 1983 would let you do, but like, I don't know. It feels like a weird use of it feels like a workaround around Ex parte Young's ban on damages.
3 points, Your Honor. First, under Ex parte Young, and Supreme Court's provided through Milliken v. Bradley, a relief under Ex parte Young can have a substantial impact on a state treasury. The operative question is whether the relief in the case sought is going to include payment of damages, retrospective relief. That's not the case here. I think we can agree that they're not going to pay us a dollar if we win or through a trial or a summary judgment. The second issue is that, as Vargo v. Casey pointed out, there simply is no prohibition or no requirement that you can't use Ex parte Young for takings claims seeking prospective relief. That is, they can take the water, but
okay, you're way over. But what's your third one? What's your third one?
I forgot.
Got the clock.
Hey, I forgot.
Your third one? Real quick.
All right. Well, look. Here's what we'll do. I'm going to give you 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
If it comes back to you, you can do it then.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Margaret Tides for appellees. I'm going to do about a quick minute of covering ground for a setup, and then I want to dive into the issues you are raising. So you were the fourth court to hear these same arguments. When the State Water Board enacted drought regulations in 2014, one of these same plaintiffs with this same firm filed suit in state court, asserting that they were entitled to the exact same relief. And as relevant here, that is an evidentiary hearing under federal due process and compensation for a taking. And that case was the Stanford Vina case, which you have referenced and both parties cite in the briefing. They lost that case. The California trial court rejected those arguments, as did the California appellate court, and the United States Supreme Court denied review. So in 2021, when the State Water Board enacted regulations in response to another emergency drought, the plaintiffs tried again, but this time in federal court, and they put forward the same legal arguments as before. And we are here today because, like the state trial court and the state appellate court, the federal trial court also rejected those arguments, and this court should affirm. The district court properly concluded that the enactment of these regulations and the issuance of curtailment orders was legislative and did not require an evidentiary hearing. The trial court also properly concluded that because of sovereign immunity, plaintiffs must bring their takings claim in state court, not here. And then I would like to dive into the questions.
Well, let me answer the question in response to that, though, because to what Judge Owens was asking about earlier as far as mootness. While your argument or your statements just made may support certain aspects of your case, it does seem to feel like a little bit of capable of repetition but evading review. It feels like this. So maybe if you just jump to that. That's the mootness issue, so maybe just jump to that. What great plans do you have for the next drought that will not mean you will do this again? You're working hard on creating fish ladders
and
whatever.
And I can jump in. The first argument in your brief was that it's moot. Mm-hmm. So we heard a lot about from you suggesting maybe it's not moot. So tell me why the first argument in your brief is right.
Well, I appreciate the question, and I acknowledge the tension. And to your point, Judge Owens, there will be a drought in California, and the Water Board retains the authority and will certainly be issuing drought regulations in the future in some form. I think the issue with this case and what it illustrates is we're talking about weather and water, and those are very fact-dependent and unpredictable and different, especially when we're also talking about different conditions on the ground. And in the resolution adopting these regulations, the board talks about why these two creeks are so tricky. There's no upland water storage that can buffer the flows on these creeks. So you're really talking about what's the snowpack that year, what's the available water, what's the...
But that's all an argument. That all would go to whether or not there's a drought. Well, we're calling whether there's a drought. Right. We're not hydrologists or whatever. But if there is a drought and the board, I assume, reasonably concludes the fish need this water and there's no way to store it up above or anything, then to their capable of repetition or evading review, it depends on whether there's really much of an option other than, I guess the options I can think of would be paying them, but you haven't so far, and you actually even have a state court decision I said you didn't need to or something. So you're paying them, and there is not doing anything and letting the steelhead die, or there's curtailing the water. It seems like, why isn't it likely that you'll do the third? Is there another plan?
If there's a drought. Absolutely. There's an example in this case. So there's actually three creeks. Antelope Creek is another creek in this system where there are threatened and protected fish. And in this case, the difference between the 2014 and the 2014.
Yeah, they included the third one in the 2014.
They didn't have to include the third one in the later regulations
that just goes back to like how bad a drought is it. Let's assume it's a super bad drought. What are you going to do that won't essentially be the same as here?
So I think they won't
think is taking their water in the way they think you're taking their water.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, I think what it illustrates is there's different, I don't like this turn of phrase, but there's different ways to skin the cat here. So with Antelope Creek in the later drought, they reached a different agreement on regulatory situation on that creek to meet the water needs. So it doesn't have to take the form
of a... What did they do?
I think it was a combination of agreements with the water users. I don't know the specifics, and it's not in the record in this case. But there are alternates to adopting emergency regulations, which I think is your point. What else could they do? Well, they could do a specific agreement and regulatory system with that specific creek, which that's in the record in the resolution adopting the regs.
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying there. You're saying they could reach an agreement with these plaintiffs to voluntarily give
yes.
them the water?
Yes, or arrange for compensation like you're suggesting. Or I was on another case involving the same, my friend on the other side, where on the Yuba River, they're now constructing a fish passage that mimics natural flows. And as my colleague referenced, there is a long history on this creek going back decades between the state and federal and local communities trying to get some form of fish passage.
So putting aside the fish passage, because yeah. I think, you know, I say, well, we're doing a project right now that will make it so this doesn't have to happen again.
Yep.
I think that would resonate.
Yeah.
I don't know whether we could, it's not on the record. I don't know. But the first one, it does seem kind of odd to say this case is moot, even though it's capable of repetition, because we could voluntarily do what they are asking you to adjudicate. Because that would always be the case, right? I'm not sure whether that isn't, you know, gets you around the capable repetition.
I understand that tension, and I think mootness is one basis, potential basis to affirm. I don't think it's the strongest, or it wasn't the emphasis of our briefing, and I think some of the issues you raised on due process and takings are really interesting, and I would like to address those my time.
Just to close out the mootness thing, it seems to me the only way that we could find the case moot would be if there is an alternative to actually taking the water away from them. And you've mentioned this Fish Creek thing, or fish...
What passage,
the super highway for the fish, yeah. but there's nothing in the record about that, is there?
No, what is in the record is the example of Antelope Creek, where this arrangement doesn't, and that's just an example. The arrangement doesn't have
it sounds
to.
Like you're not sure, but the example of Antelope Creek could have been compensating them for the water, which kind of brings us back.
It said a regulatory and in the record, it's in the resolution adopting the regulations, it says a different regulatory agreement was reached with the users on Antelope Creek. So we're not going to impose these regulations on that creek. So it is an alternative.
Go ahead, move on to what you want to move on to.
Okay. And thank you. Thanks. I'll spend the remainder of my time addressing due process and takings. So on due process, the rule is that citizens don't get to cross-examine our legislators when they enact law or take legislative action. And this goes to your point, Judge Van Dyke, about the distinction between legislative and adjudicatory being the crux of this issue. And under case law, how do we tell when something's legislative?
Right. But I'm not sure that, like, the rationale for that distinction is so much, you know, we don't get to cross-examine legislators. As I understand it, the primary rationale that I'm seeing is you can't do 22,000 adjudicatory actions, right? So I'm not sure I agree with your colleague on the other side that numbers don't matter. But how does that is that a primary concern? How does that play in this case?
Well, I think that is the rationale, is that government would grind to a halt if the state or federal government had to conduct thousands of, evidentiary
thousands
hearings.
Thousands here. There's 22, and it's not even clear that 22 people would want to speak. It sounds like three that are the really being hugely affected, and that really starts to feel more like, you know, something you could do as an adjudication.
Right. And I think the case law provides really helpful guideposts, but I agree. I was looking for something more on point. So I tried to think of some hypotheticals. And I'm born and raised in Reno. And growing up, we had slot machines in our grocery stores. You could gamble and go get groceries. And in these gambling sections of grocery stores, you could also smoke. And eventually, at one point, they passed a law saying no more smoking in these public areas, where, especially where there tends to be minors around, like grocery stores. And by the time this law was rolled out, most grocery stores had kind of phased this out. But I remember that, you know, one or two holdouts where you could still smoke and sit and gamble in the grocery store. But that act, even if when it went into effect, there were only one or two, let's make it extreme, right? Not 22, let's make it one or two stores, we're still allowing this. That act would still be legislative because it applied across the entire class of grocery stores.
Okay, so using your hypo, what if What if the act actually said the grocery outlet, my favorite grocery store here in town, the grocery outlet stores.
Yeah.
Have to get rid of their, or, I don't think they have slot machines, but like have to get rid of their smoking slot machines.
Yes.
Would that be adjudicatory or legislative?
Yes, thank you. And I was like, the Raley's on the corner of Plum, right? If they target one specific grocery store, that is like Harris.
What about two?
Two, great. And I think, I think we could play with this, right?
Yeah, this feels here like three. That's why I'm getting you to three. I'm not going to try to get you 22 because it feels like they're targeting three.
Sure.
At the end of the day, if they could just get these three major water users on that too, like if they would come and give them all their water, they probably would have enough. So,
yeah.
So that three starts to feel very close to one and two.
I like this hypothetical. Let's say that there are 65 grocery stores, because there's 65 water rights here, but they're franchised. So they're owned by different people, right? And that's what we have here. We have 65 different water rights, but they're held by 22 people. And so we could play with this and say, okay, what if you do have more because of the way that you're holding or hotels in Oakland? What if they're owned by one person? It is still legislative if it applies across the class of all of them. I mean, let's say you had a monopoly on the hotels in Oakland. I think it would be absurd to say that a law that applied to all the hotels is now adjudicatory simply because you've monopolized the market.
Yeah, that's why it seems to me, and your colleague on our side didn't seem to be agreeing with this, but it seems to me sort of the portion of the whole has some resonance because I thought it was a pretty powerful example in their brief about the Market Street, except for I thought their Market Street, you remember the example in the brief?
Yes.
I thought that was kind of they actually didn't use that example as strongly as they could have. I think it would have been a better example if they said one block on Market Street, because there's probably on one block of Market Street, there may be 22 landowners, say, on one block of Market Street. And it really does feel like if San Francisco said for one block of Market Street, past that example they gave, that starts to feel like adjudicatory, like they're just, like they're taking, it feels like, well, why couldn't you give process to those 22 landowners as opposed to the entirety of Market Street or the entirety of San Francisco?
I think that gets closer, but this case is not a close call like that. So I think...
Why is it this case exactly like 22 landowners on one block on Market Street, 22 water right holders on two creeks that form a tiny, teeny weeny minority of the water controlled by the California Board?
So 2 points. I think one... The comparative standard is not anywhere apparent in case law. That is not supported by case law. And I think carrying...
The problem if you don't have a comparative standard is then if you have a small board, then it will always be... everything would always require... If it's a small board that only regulates like three people, it would never be able to do anything legislative. So it seems it has to be comparative almost, but not?
I think... That one, it is not supported in the case law to add this like denominator math. But two, I think the issue is more with agencies with large jurisdictions is the problem. So if we're comparing to the denominator of that electoral class, and you think about federal agencies that are regulating, their jurisdiction is the entire United States, federal agencies would be holding evidentiary hearings for anything.
I totally, those are all concerns. But if we don't have some sort of comparative standard, then we're just sitting here being like, does 22 water rights holders feel like a lot? Does 22 landowners on Market Street feel like a lot? Does it seems like it has to have some sort of comparative aspect to the agency's global reach, right?
I think what I have been comparing to is the case law as guideposts, right? Like, does this feel like the short case law, the shore of Bainbridge Island? And for reference, the area at issue here in this case is three times larger than the city of Reno. So we're talking about a large area. It's larger than the shore of Bainbridge Island. And in terms of quantities, right, the hotels at issue in Oakland, it was the non-conforming use hotels. And so I'm thinking, okay, 65 water rights held by 22 people. We're in the ballpark of where these cases are saying large area and more than a few individuals. It is not like Harris, which dealt with one parcel, one person, a focused action. And I see...
Well, Harris actually dealt with more than one, right? It's just it said one was especially affected. It was a small, it said a few, and then Harris was, one was particularly effective?
I think it was guised as a general plan, but the actual rezoning was this one, Mr. Harris's one parcel was rezoned, effectively putting him out of business.
I thought it actually said that it was more than one. I don't know that it was 22, but that Harris was especially affected. And Harris had, of course, been the one that brought the lawsuit. So I think the court then focused on Harris from then on out.
May I make a very short point on takings?
Go for it.
Thank you. So I think of this as a time traveling takings claim. And he's my friend on the other side is arguing effectively that we can bring a claim for compensation against a non-consenting sovereign in federal court simply by seeking to collect money tomorrow rather than today. And that would abrogate and put the Fifth Amendment above the 11th Amendment. And that is not supported by case law. And the district court here specifically cited the 74 Pinehurst case that collects the circuit unanimity on this. And regarding Vargo, which was cited in the reply, not only is that a non-binding out-of-circuit case, but it's distinguishable. So in Vargo, the plaintiffs took issue with the method of calculating compensation. They said, you're calculating this wrong. And that was because of that, the legal remedy was fundamentally inadequate. And that's different here, where plaintiffs are expressly saying, we don't have an issue with how you're calculating this or the process for compensation. We just want compensation. And it's not that they can't bring that claim. They have to do it in state court.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much for your time.
We heard the words in regards to Harris v. Riverside, guise of a general plan, and that's very important here, is because in Harris, it was a general plan for the whole county that, in substance, the court examined the number of impacted people and whether they're exceptionally affected to find that a zoning change tucked in there did trigger due process rights.
So you agree, or at least my understanding of Harris, that it involved one exceptionally affected person, or at least one, but then had other people affected. What was the number of total people in Harris?
My recollection is it was not just one. There was more, but I do not remember, Your Honor, and so I'm reluctant to comment on that. But the point is that it was on its face a general plan amendment. The court went to the substance of it. That's not what we have here. This on its face is adjudicating their diversion and use of the property rights as unreasonable and confiscating for a public use. And so we're much closer to Londoner than Bimetallic. Justice Holmes explaining in Bimetallic, due process not applicable to general statutes within the state power, which affect all who are equally concerned and stand alike, unlike Londoner, which concerned adjudicating rights on, I believe it was a street or a sidewalk. This is Londoner, not Bimetallic. This is not general on its face, doesn't purport to be. Few other points that I'd like to address on the mootness issue. What would stop the state? We know we have droughts coming. We know the fish are coming back. They themselves acknowledge how special these creeks are. This is the way they're going to do it. They've done it in 4 of 7 years. No hearing, no compensation, 3.5 business days notice. What government actor could restrain themselves?
What about this other fish ladder or bypass that she was talking about?
I don't think there's anything about that in the record, but what is in the record is the omission of Antelope Creek in 2021 and 2022. That just shows they're more focused on the plaintiffs in this case. Vargo v. Casey, we heard that legal remedy was inadequate. I don't think that's an accurate characterization of the case. The court found that the relief, declaratory relief one, was a milder pill than an injunction, so didn't violate the prohibition on injunctive relief for takings claims. The court actually said that. And second, that the plaintiffs weren't trying to enjoin a taking, to stop a taking. There was a reference to compensation being paid for future actions. That's not accurate. Our prayer is for declaratory relief and injunction, saying if this is going to continue in the future prospectively, that they're to conform with the constitutional requirements of a due process hearing and compensation that's consistent with Ex parte Young, that is to conform officers to the Constitution and federal law prospectively. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Thanks to both of you for taking our many questions. This matter is submitted.